For the audio record, today is March 5th, 2025. Today's argument is being live streamed, and we are also making an audio recording. The audio record of today's hearing will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. As a reminder, there are no other recordings permitted without the express permission of the Court of Appeals. With that, we have three cases on our oral argument calendar this morning. And seeing that counsel are here, I will call the first case, which is case number A24-1618, State of Minnesota v. Christian Dior Byrd. Good morning, counsel. Thank you for making the trip through the weather this morning. As I'm sure both of you know, you will be each given 15 minutes for your argument this morning, and appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before beginning your argument, because we make an audio record, we would ask that you please identify yourself and your client for the audio record. And then please feel free to take time to adjust the podium to your comfort before beginning your argument. So, with that, counsel for appellant, if you are ready, you may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Nate Summers. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the appellant, State of Minnesota, in this case. This court should reverse the district court's dismissal of carjacking charges against the respondent, Christian Byrd, because the state did not unnecessarily delay the prosecution of his case, nor did it violate his right to speedy trial. Before I begin, I'd like to highlight just a few points that I think the parties agree on. First, the district court its dismissal had a critical impact on the state's ability to prosecute the case. Second, that Trooper Hall was a necessary witness and was on FMLA, Family Medical Leave Act, parental leave during the entirety of that January 16th trial date and that week. And I think we agree on this. I'm sure I'll be corrected if we don't. The only delay directly attributed to the state is the delay caused by the state's dismissal after our continuance request was denied by the district court. With that, I want to focus on 3 points with my initial time. First and most importantly, this court should consider this appeal with speedy trial case law in mind, not confrontation.
Before you get to that, Judge, I missed what you, that last sentence prior to this, you said the parties agree that the only reason for the delay was the state's dismissal.
The only delay in the case is this that's attributable to the state. So the only reason that is essentially my fault, the state's fault, was the delay caused by the state's dismissal after our continuance request was denied. The rest of, and I can get to this, I had planned on getting this a little bit later. I'm happy to step in now. The rest of the delay in this case was caused by Mr. Byrd absconding from EHM, Mr. Byrd failing to appear, and I want to say a May 2024 hearing, and Mr. Byrd's litigation of this issue before trial rather than demanding a speedy trial on the front end. The most important point, though, that I want to convey is this court should consider this appeal with speedy trial case law in mind, not confrontation clause case law. The second point that I'd like to make today is that Trooper Hall was unavailable for purposes of the state's continuance. So, applying the correct standard of law, Trooper Hall was unavailable. And
Can I? What are we to do, Mr. Summers, with the fact that your office didn't know of his unavailability until the jury was already there? It seems to me that's something you should have known well before that.
certainly, I mean, in an ideal world, we would have known about it. The reason we didn't know about it was because of that typo, 216 versus 116. The way that our subpoenas are responded to, we have a system called Subpoena Plus. You get a blue thumbs up for a witness that's available that week, red thumbs down with a short reason why they're not. Trooper Hall's was red thumbs down on FMLA until 116, 23, 24, 116, the day of the first day of trial. When we were looking at that in our system, we said, okay, that's great. There's no possible way we're going to call Trooper Hall on the Monday of trial. And that's kind of borne out in the record, too. So I guess if your question is, why is this case not like Carlson? It's not like Carlson because we confirmed the subpoena. Carlson's a case cited in respondent's brief. We confirmed the subpoena, it just was confirmed incorrectly. And that's not a reason that I think you can, that can be fairly attributed to the state. That's just a typo. These things happen.
I had a question with regard to the application and what is the correct case law. And I guess I've been a bit confused It seems to me that we're here on a challenge to the district court making a decision under Rule 30.02. And can you explain to me sort of the intersection of the district court's analysis under 30.02 with the constitutional case law and how those two sort of intersect? I mean, because the way I read the district court's order is they sort of made one decision under 30.02 and then they made another decision under the Constitution. And is there some place at which that analysis intersects, or is Rule 30.02 a separate and distinct analysis from the constitutional analysis?
Absolutely. I think that's it's a fair point. I think too, they're related, but not, right? We need to win on both to win this appeal. I'll candidly say that we need to win both on the, I think the 30.02 candidly is a more difficult standard because it is abuse of discretion. But they're related because they're all about unnecessary delay. Speedy trial is about the timing of the trial. I think it's really hard for anyone to stand up and say that a 30-day delay is unnecessary, especially when our witness has a statutory right that we were trying to respect. Even if the district court didn't agree, we were in a situation where this witness said, I'm not coming, I have a statutory privilege. The state went through the supervisor, we went through our civil division, which deals with FMLA a lot more than the criminal division does. And candidly, the consultation with civil was essentially a shrug. They found the same thing that the state, the defense at the trial level, the defense at this level, and the district court found was that there's no case law out there.
Can I ask you, that being the case, we can start with the judge wasn't wrong, right? Wrong, right? Because there's no law, and the only law that you cited, FMLA, is that an employer can't interfere with it. But isn't it true that your entire, the principle of basis of your entire argument rests on your presumption as a matter of law and maybe fact that the officer was not available until his FMLA ended? And yet you have no authority for that proposition. So how do we accept that proposition? And maybe to say it another way, I'm assuming, are you saying that any witness to a crime who happens to be on FMLA at the time of the trial, where their speedy trial has been made, is unavailable?
If they're on FMLA leave?
Yes. And
I
if
would
so,
say,
on what basis would they be unavailable to honor a court subpoena?
I would say it's really fact dependent. And that's why I didn't ask for a precedential opinion that says that FMLA leave automatically relieves a victim, or a witness, I should say, of testifying. I think in this case, you know, the problem with this case is that the district court said, and frankly, with the arguments here, the district court said, okay, Trooper Hall has a statutory right. Mr. Byrd has a constitutional right. We're going to weigh them binary. What are the
but
other?
A statute, maybe what I'm missing, a statutory right to what?
To parental leave, to not.
Right, but what's the relevance of that to a court-issued subpoena to appear for a trial?
Well, especially for a police officer, where testifying is a job duty. I do think that testifying would be one of the things that would be covered by the FMLA. I think that that would be.
Is testifying mentioned in the FMLA?
Not directly, no.
Indirectly?
Well, it's a job duty, right? And that's why this—that's why the State Patrol has their own internal FMLA policy based on the FMLA that says that we're not going to force troopers to testify when they're on parental leave.
But the judge made the point, and that's kind of what I'm getting at. It, and I. You haven't provided an answer to it, is how, under what authority could a statutory parental leave trump a district court's issuance of a subpoena?
And I'm saying that that analysis is wrong. We're not talking about one or the other. We're in the world of speedy trial, which is a flexible four-factor test, right?
But in effect, isn't that what you're arguing, though? Because you're saying, that's why I started out with, all your arguments are on the premise he was literally, factually, and legally unavailable.
Well,
and
I think
the judge
record
pointed out, well, he's not unavailable. He's just not willing to come in and testify because he happens to be on FMLA.
And so, I guess I would push back on that a little bit because there are no facts in the record that says that he was available, right? All the facts are, I'm on FMLA, I'm taking care of my newborn child, my wife is back to work. The idea that he could have had somebody step in wasn't proffered until, at least in the record, I certainly wasn't aware of it as a trial prosecutor until that September evidentiary hearing, right? All the back and forth was, I'm on FMLA, I can't come, I'm not going to come, you can't force me. And frankly, we were kind of stuck between a rock and a slightly less hard place.
Sure. But you can force him because it's a court ordered subpoena. I mean, just maybe to make a hypothetical, if I was a witness to a crime and the trial happened to be when I was on FMLA leave, you might jump for joy because my schedule is much more open when I'm on FMLA leave than it is when I am working full time and you're trying to get the witness to appear. And so it does seem like there is a bit of a disconnect from an analytical perspective that there should be sort of this special exception for cops to have to comply with court-ordered subpoenas when they are on FMLA leave, when if this was some other witness that was served a court-ordered subpoena to appear on a day, I don't know that the prosecutor's office would even ask that witness whether or not they were on FMLA leave.
I guess 2 points to kind of answer that. First is that we didn't know about FMLA leave until day one of trial, right, that Monday, because of the typo, which is why we're kind of against this time crunch. All the decisions that were made in this case were made with a jury out in the hallway, right? It's not like we had time. And I think that Judge Quam's order alludes to this too. If we had known a week, a month, 3 months when we set the subpoena out, that Trooper Hall was going to be on FMLA leave, we would have had time to figure this out. I think the Trooper Hall from the September evidentiary hearing would have been able to find coverage. We would have been able to kind of come to a way to get around it. With the time crunch, with the facts of the case, and the other, it just makes it almost, impossible to do that. And the other side of that coin there is that as a trooper, you know, this is a job duty, right? It's not a civilian witness who witnessed a crime, who has, you know, all the time in the world to come in. And I also push back on that a little bit too. FMLA leave, you're doing an essential duty, right? FMLA leave is all about providing care for family members, for newborn children. It's an important thing to do, right?
Well, which comes back to my question. Do you ask your fact witnesses whether or not they're on FMLA leave before you serve them a court-ordered subpoena to appear in court when they are taking care of their child and doing that duty?
Yeah. I mean, candidly, in my practice, yes. FMLA leave is usually a red thumb down, right? And so that's something we work around. I can't say it's happened often. I can't say it happened often, but I do think that it's an important duty, right? Not just FMLA leave, right? If you have witnesses who have like parenting duties or something like that, that is something that the state works around. I had a mentor in law school who said the worst part about trial prep isn't the trial, it's herding the cats to get everybody there at the right time with the right evidence.
Isn't it true, counsel, that the judge, and I think the judge mentioned this in a footnote, was willing to accommodate the timing of his testimony now that you found out at the last, first day of trial that he was refusing to come in. So without having to have a continuance of the trial. So it seemed like there was an accommodation made by the judge and flexibility during the week long, I think it was anticipated to be trial, so that he could maybe get an extra day to get, whether his wife could take a day off or he could find a grandparent or something. And that seemed like that was the whole point of the evidentiary hearing, is he truly unavailable? And it still kind of comes back to, he was not willing to come in because he was on FMLA. But it looks like there was time to make an accommodation for him to do it, but he was just refusing to come. And you accepted that, which is why you said he's available in 30 days or whatever the time period, because you're just presuming that anybody on FMLA just is not available and therefore need not honor a subpoena.
Well, I think this is from a footnote from the district court's dismissal. Is that accurate? That wasn't the position of this court at the jury trial setting. The jury trial setting was he's not unavailable. He is unavailable. He just doesn't want to come in. I don't think there's any record of the court saying, well, I'm not going to grant your continuance for 30 days, but I'll grant it for three. So
I read that footnote. He was going to not grant any continuance. And you kind of, of course, knew that you had the discussions, but he was willing to accommodate the timing. So if he needed an extra day, so if this was a Monday and he needed a Tuesday, so he could come in on Wednesday. The point, it sounded like the court was flexible, but the difference is you were just taking the position, then you don't have to.
Well, it also doesn't get us around the issue of, you know, both the witness and the state trooper, so his supervisors and his higher-up saying that he's not coming in.
Didn't that strike you as a bit presumptuous, whether it's him or his supervisor? And I think the judge, I can kind of reading between the lines, that's part of why the frustration of the judge, Judge Quam, is wondering how possibly can that trump a court-issued subpoena without some litigation about that or an attempt to enforce it?
I mean, it certainly frustrated us. Candidly, we were much more concerned with tracking down the victim. In the prep of this case, we found him, I want to say that Friday. We prepped him that Monday, and so we were ready to go on everything, and then all of a sudden this typo thing pops up. Had there more timing, there would have been an opportunity for that litigation. But for that typo, I think that's kind of where the facts of the case come together. It made it very difficult to make those arguments. I also think that, you know, that footnote several months after the trial setting, the record at the trial was much more, I'm not going to grant a continuance. Granted, a lot of the conversations happened in chambers, so they're not on the record. But I just don't think that flexibility was there. I don't think that the court has a record of that, aside from that footnote, well after the fact.
Your brief, Mr. Summers, talks about a lot about the things that respondent did to delay the trial by absconding and things like that after the recharge. Is that the only relevant period of time that you think we should be looking at is from the time you recharged to when it got to trial to judge the whether the district court abused its discretion here in dismissing this complaint?
I see my time's expired. Can I answer the question? Yes. No, I think that the period of time should be the whole thing, right? So from offense until, well, here, I guess, right? We haven't even had a trial yet. The period of time that the states here for, and procedural history in this case is important, right, is these dates, you know, 30 days. Less, frankly, because we filed and then, or dismissed and then refiled the case a few days later. Even if this court doesn't find that Trooper Hall was unavailable, the length of the delay in this case was so short that the delay was not unnecessarily long and didn't violate his speedy trial rights. With that, I'll be back for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you may begin when you're ready. And again, feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort.
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the respondent in this case, Mr. Christian Byrd. Being a respondent in this somewhat rare instance, I find myself...
You sat at the right table, though. That's yes. Good.
Step one.
I feel the need to just, if I may, respond directly to some of the questions and points that were raised. I mean, the first thing I would like to emphasize, consistent with the questions posed by Judge Sleater, is there is no provision in the FMLA that excuses people on family leave from a court subpoena. There is no provision that talks about them being able to stay home from court when they have a court order to do so. Now, I made a big deal in my brief about the fact that Judge Quam was never actually presented with any provisions of the FMLA at the district court. It was just State v. Olson. And the trooper, the authority that the trooper was citing and that the state backed up was the state patrol policy. I think what I take from this record, I mean, I know Judge Quam really well. He's the most civil, patient judge I think I've ever known, but he was protecting judicial integrity. I mean, this was a case where a state patrol trooper was arbitrarily refusing to come in because he was on parental leave. I mean, I think the question from Judge Larson is simply that actually when someone is on FMLA, they should have more availability. And Judge Quam asked for a hearing, you know, instead of just ruling, to see if the state could present a viable reason, factual and or legal, as to why he was unavailable. And all he did was say, my state office policy says I don't have to testify. So that's not even a statutory basis. That's an agency administrative policy for refusing to testify. I'm also noting that the state here is conceding that the victim was the most important witness. Well, then they should have proceeded they should have proceeded without their trooper witness refusing to testify, because the witness presumably could provide evidence of all of the elements of the carjacking offense. But the state chose to dismiss. And that is where I take issue with the last thing the state claims we're all in agreement on. I do not agree that the only delay attributable to the state was up to January 17th. Every day after that was attributable to the state because they dismissed and recharged. Everything had to be reset. It was unnecessary. To answer the question about the intersection of Rule 3002 and the speedy trial right, I relied on State v. Banks, which says that 3002 flows from the constitutional speedy trial right. They are joined at the hip.
And so your analysis would be that we have to reach the constitutional issue to decide. No. This was really where that question is, and I want to ask this of you too. Is Rule 30.02 a separate basis upon which we could affirm Judge Quam, or do we need to say, do we need to analyze the constitutionality of the speedy trial right in order to get to the whether Judge Quam abused his discretion in making his 3002 decision?
See, ironically, in light of appellant's attempt to say Davis v. Alaska can't possibly apply here, 3002 is a related and yet sort of narrowed down speedy trial right issue. It's a question simply of delay. It's like...
Well, it does certainly seem broader than the constitutionality of a speedy trial claim. That's, does the district court decide that the prosecutor has unnecessarily delayed the proceeding? Seems broader than have you actually violated the Constitution?
If you'll forgive me, I actually see that as a narrower focus.
Okay.
Because the only issue here, and I think Judge Quam focused on that primarily, and that's how his order was written, was the delay that the state was imposing by dismissing and recharging necessary. It was either necessary or unnecessary, in a sense being the binary proposition that he claims Davis was all about. I also disagree with his characterization of Davis, because Davis also involved a Sixth Amendment trial right. And the issue there was, could they confront the juvenile with his probation record or not? The answer was no. But Davis still had to do the harm analysis, just like here. The corollaries are a lot more plain. But the district court here focused primarily on the question of unnecessarily delayed, because that issue was dispositive. That's why I see it as a more direct route to the question of violating the right to a speedy trial than the corollary speedy analysis that was done secondarily. I'm not getting the sense that I'm answering your question.
No, you're answering my question. I appreciate it.
Okay. I again ultimately will rely on Banks, which expressly stated that Rule 3002 flows from the constitutional right to a speedy trial. Now, I was going to say also, in case I didn't before, that I mean, Judge Quam also considered whether it was just going to be another 30 days before he made the decision to dismiss. I realize that was after the fact. I mean, he considered everything. He said he was willing to accommodate a brief delay. The state refused. The fact is, every day after January 17th was caused by the state's decision to dismiss and recharge. If they had just, I mean, it sounds like Judge Quam would have said, okay, let's do another week so Trooper Hall can get his child care coverage. This, of course, being after Trooper Hall admitted during the hearing that he could have gotten coverage. I mean, I know I was on a trial team for 10 years, and I know that the county attorney's office has a victim and witness coordinator division in their office whose sole responsibility once trial is coming is to make sure the witnesses are available. I'm not buying that this comes down to a simple typo. Okay, I've always thought that the Hennepin County Attorney's Office was spot on in terms of making sure their witnesses were there once we were going to trial, because that meant, well, we didn't work it out. So they were bringing everything.
Mr. Mayor Vili, though it's not in the rule, case law has made it pretty clear that prejudice is a prong of the 3002, which I assume then does bring it as into at least that portion of the constitutional prong.
Yes, Judge.
My question for you is what's your best argument for how your client was prejudiced, notwithstanding,
yes.
This is when we get into all the bad things from your client's perspective that happened after the arraignment on the new complaint and the other offense that was pending, and then the Freeborn County matter.
Well, I actually double-checked that yesterday. It's State v. Hart that said that prejudice, a finding of it is necessary with a 3002 ruling. So that much is clear, and that again shows how it's related to the speedy trial right. But in looking at the judge's order again, it seems that what he did was just distill it down to the fact that this was a clear deprivation of a constitutional right, and he cited Griffin for that. He looked at all the other considerations that would go into the normal speedy trial analysis, like was the defense going to be impacted or harmed, things of that nature. But it's clear that what Judge Quam saw here was an utterly unnecessary delay. It was preventable in probably six different ways. If the state had fulfilled their procedural and constitutional burden to provide the speedy trial, that's the state's burden. It wasn't Mr. Byrd's. Throughout the record in December and then at the January hearing, the state kept saying, we know we're under speedy. We know we're under speedy. So the prejudice here, and I think Judge Quam noted that it was somewhat distinctive, was the court's finding that, one, the right was being denied. It was being denied arbitrarily. And what I take from his ruling was that it was the arbitrariness of the state here, when they're the ones that had the duty to make sure this speedy trial happened, that inflicted the harm, inflicted the prejudice for an in-custody defendant. See, one of the other things I noted before today is that, I mean, I've read a lot of speedy trial case law. It almost always involves the defendant failing to assert their right to speedy, or more commonly, there have been delays, but the state has provided good reasons for them. I mean, most of the speedy trial jurisprudence upholds the denial of a speedy trial violation claim for those reasons, either.
Well, which is one possible reading of Olson, right? That in that case, the district court determined that for whatever reason.
But see, that's the thing. I mean, that's what I think Judge Quam might have been the most frustrated about. See, Olson affirmed a district court's finding that the witness was unavailable, but it never said why. And that's what Judge, I think if the case of Olson had actually said exactly why the witness was unavailable due to paternity leave, he would have given the continuance, but it doesn't. And Olson specifically noted that it couldn't overrule the district court because it wasn't an abuse of discretion for the court to find the witness unavailable. So Judge Quam carefully considered, well, he could be unavailable here if he was like in the hospital, if he was out of the country, or if he had some other emergency. None of that was presented. And he noted
his baby was in the NICU. His wife had birth the same day. I mean, there are reasons you can be on parental leave where you also would be physically unavailable.
Certainly.
To show up at trial.
But just that fact, if the baby was in the NICU at the, see, I don't remember that, but if the baby.
No. I'm stating a hypothetical.
Oh.
Hypothetically.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hypothetically, there are reasons that you could both be on paternity leave and be physically unavailable to appear at trial. For example, your baby's in the NICU. There, your wife is having some kind of complications post birth. Right. Like there are factual scenarios where you would be unavailable and on paternity leave.
Yes, and this is why Judge Quam wanted to have the hearing. He wanted to give the state a chance to show unavailability the way they clearly did in Olson, but they didn't. And that's why Judge Quam couldn't apply Olson, because he allowed the witness to be tested. Please give me something. He never did. And it was the defense that elicited from the witness that, with proper notice, he could get coverage to come and testify. Even after all that testimony, the state still refused to budge and say, no, he's not coming in.
I will say, I do think that the one thing that I find more complicated, maybe in this case, than sort of a black and white FMLA case is, I do think that there is this distinction, right, with police officers that when they get a court ordered subpoena, that that is part of their job as opposed to a normal fact witness. And I guess, how are we, like, do you agree that that's sort of a fact intensive inquiry with regard to balancing the fact that testifying as a police officer is part of your job? You're not just a normal fact witness. So being brought into trial really is working from the perspective of a police officer. And how do we balance that? We do want to give police officers opportunities to be on leave. And I think that that's part of what's happening here, right? Is we have supervisors wanting to give their employees opportunities to bond with their children after they are born. And how do we balance that within the analysis here?
My immediate response to that is the FMLA was written with the idea that everybody, regardless of their job, has that right to bond with their child and be home with that child. Okay, I had FMLA twice through my office. But I don't think that police are entitled to any extra deference, whether because of the, you know, hazardous nature of their job, the fact that they have to work all night sometimes, that their work schedule is tougher. I know that. I was a police officer myself. I know that. But I think Judge Quam brought to bear Mr. Byrd's rights. Those were what were in competition here with the state's obligation to produce its witness. And that's why Judge Quam came down the way he did. In the end, it's no competition. This is a Sixth Amendment right that was being arbitrarily denied. And I'll say again, I think it was the arbitrariness that was at work here that was the basis for the finding of prejudice. And I think that's evident from the order. I hope I answered your question. Trooper Hall, if anything, being a civil servant and a government employee, should have been aware that he needed to get coverage for a couple of hours because he had a court order to appear and offer testimony. And I guess I'll have to leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, I think I want to make 2 points here. The first is to prejudice, right? We've recognized that prejudice applies to both the 3002 and the speedy trial analysis. There's simply no prejudice here. Mr. Byrd was released because of the state's dismissal. I think the record's pretty clear. Mr. Byrd's currently in the DOC on that Assault 2 case. The only reason he was released from custody is because the state had to dismiss this case.
But why isn't part of our prejudice analysis that if you had been required to bring the case to trial without the trooper, that you would have had that witness would not have been there, and that, you know, maybe improved his chances of being found not guilty? I mean, it does seem to me that there's some aspect of prejudice that we're maybe beating around the bush here, which is the state had a demonstrably weaker case if it went to trial on that day. And so how is that not weighed in, or why don't we weigh that into our prejudice analysis?
I guess I would point to the court. I'd point the court to the three factors for the prejudice analysis. Some of the paper down there. But they're essentially, memory of victim or memory of the witnesses, right? We know that Judge Quam found that there are no defense witnesses other than Mr. Byrd, right? To the extent that the delay prejudiced anyone, it delayed or prejudiced the state, because our witnesses are now going to have to, well, assuming that things go the right way for the state, we're at a year and a half since the offense. Trial would have taken place, 90 days after the speedy trial demand, had the continuance been granted. Prejudice also doesn't exist in the vacuum, right? So he had the pending assault cases. He was released on those. None of that would have happened had it not been for the state's dismissal. So prejudice there just doesn't really come into it. I think that answers your question.
Well, I guess I still don't understand why we don't weigh into the analysis the fact that the state would have had a weaker case if it had been forced to proceed on that date, and how that's not a fact that we are required to weigh as part of the prejudice analysis.
And I think that's why State v. Sham says that if you litigate the dismissal on the front end and you don't, again, repeat your speedy trial demand, because the court doesn't have a jury verdict to look at, right? If we had been for, if, you know.
No, but we have the fact that you decided, rather than proceeding, to dismiss the charges, which would indicate that the state, in fact, believed that it had a demonstrably weaker case with the trooper not appearing at the trial.
He's definitely he's definitely a key witness, right? That's why we had to dismiss the case. That's why that delay was necessary. But had the case after
well, why
recharged...
shouldn't we perceive the dismissal as the state trying to do a runaround Judge Quam's decision not to grant you a continuance?
I wouldn't call it a runaround. I mean, Judge Quam explicitly said the state can recharge this. If Judge Quam had said at that hearing, if the state dismisses and recharge, I'm going to dismiss this under 3002, I think we'd be in a very different situation, right?
But isn't it true, Mr. Summer, that he was just stating what the law is, which is true, and Olson made it clear there need not be a finding of bad faith for a prosecutor to dismiss under 3001, although it might become relevant now when we get into 3002 land. But isn't it true? I mean, when we talk about the trooper and his special role, it seems to me that the obligation of him kind of feeds into a decision that your office would have, and that is, well, look, we're proceeding. You don't have a legal right not to honor this subpoena, and I know it gets back to the other issue, so we're going to proceed, and it's on you if we don't win because of the point that was made. You just chose not to come, which was the finding the court made, and it sounds like from the evidence you're hearing was accurate. Or the option you would have had is, okay, well, then we're just going to dismiss this case if you thought it was you're not going to have any chance to win, although you had the victim, so I think you had a pretty good chance anyway. But isn't that really the context of a trooper who's the key witness deciding I'm not going to come in?
Well, that's again where we're between a rock and a hard place, right? What the alternative then is to say, okay, trooper, you're not going to come. Well, we're going to send your partner to go arrest you. I'm not sure that would have happened, right? Judge Quam kind of says in his order.
Well, don't you think? I think that's part of what Judge Quam was getting at. There are means to enforce it, and I'm suspecting with statement that would happen if you don't gets him to calling and say, well, look, here's what's happening. And pretty soon they say, well, yeah, you got a subpoena, you got an honor. And I bet that he would have come in whether the next day or 2 days later, don't you think?
Well, and I think that ignores kind of my last point that I want to make here is that we're not in a binary situation, right? We're in a place where Trooper Hall's parental leave can be respected. It can be done in harmony with Mr. Byrd's right to speedy trial. We're not in a situation where it's confrontation, confront or not. We're in a situation where we're asking for 30 days. That's not an unnecessary delay, even though Judge Quam disagreed. And the fact that, if I could just briefly conclude, the case was dismissed on a technicality. If the district court, and the district court said that, right, in its order, this is a technicality. A lot of people look at it as a technicality. If the district court's going to dismiss the case on a technicality, it needs to technically address the correct case law. It shouldn't have relied on confrontation case law. For those reasons and the reasons of my brief, I would ask this court reverse the district court and send the case back for trial.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your briefing and your argument in this matter. The case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the matter in the time prescribed by statute. And now we will see if the lawyers in the second case have made it through the snow.